This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The greatest nation on earth does not conduct its business in month-to-month increments.
Oh, yes, it does, Mr. President. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 1st of March is upon us. Good as always to have you with us. This is one of those weeks I think we can safely say that needs no introduction. So I won't. Here for the next 4 minutes of live radio to help figure out what the heck happened are Heidi Moore from The Guardian in New York and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He's down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So, you know, that's the second week in a row that whoever our lucky victims are have responded exactly in unison. All right. I am going to play you a piece of tape from the President of the United States, and the question that comes out of it will be a true-false one. Here we go.
Every time that we get a piece of economic news over the next month, next 2 months, next 6 months, as long as the sequester is in place, we'll know that that economic news could have been better if Congress had not failed to act.
Heidi Moore, true, false?
False.
How come?
Because our economic data hasn't been great already. Just because the sequester is happening doesn't mean we can put it all on the sequester.
I surprised you. I turned it into an essay question, didn't I?
Yes. I thought it was a choose-your-own-adventure. I was going to say he should chew through the ropes and confront the thugs.
But. Yes, well, that's a whole different interview. Sudeep Reddy, true or false what the president just said?
Partially true. We will be going through all of this. It's why I'm making it one.
Right.
We will see in the coming months that everything will have this layer of uncertainty around it. We have other problems from the last fight, from the fiscal cliff, with payroll taxes having gone up. It's going to really muddy all of our understanding of the economy. But the sequester will hurt the economy. There's really no way getting around that.
Heidi, he said number of months. How many do you suppose until this is no longer an economic problem? Forget political, economic problem.
Well, it's really hard to tell just because it's hard to tell where our economy is. We've had some good data. We've had some bad data. So it's not as if we have perfect knowledge of where we are in terms of coming out of this recession so that we can tell where we're going to go. You know, it's not like a map. It's not like you're in your car.
Yeah.
So, you know, this could go on for months. Where that would put us, we're not on such a great path already. I mean, we're probably going to be stagnating for the next few months, whether or not the sequester happens.
Sudeep, March the 27th is when the money for the United States government runs out. There's conceivably a government shutdown looming then. That's going to be worse, right?
It will be worse in terms of being noticeable. That is where everything really hits us, where you see parks shut down, you see museums close, all the things that we saw back in the mid-1990s and the government shutdown you'd see again. But that is also where the first solution could be to this sequester battle that we're facing now, because any deal to avoid a government shutdown could address parts of the budget cuts that are starting today and that could be most painful. And so in some ways, this first month of sequestration could be a mini preview of a government shutdown to give us a little bit of a flavor of what we could see down the road.
I hadn't actually thought of that. Heidi, what do you think of that?
You know, the thing is, we're really good at government shutdowns. We've had 16 of them since the Carter administration, and in no case has Congress leapt into action to stop them from happening. To Congress, that's, you know, it's a non-concern in terms of letting a government shutdown happen. So the people who suffer are the people on military bases, the people who need federal doctors, all the people who get, you know, government services.
Speaking of non-concern, Heidi, why does Wall Street not seem to care about any of this stuff?
Because finally, Wall Street has learned its lesson. At long last, it's the Congress that cried drama, and Wall Street's just not falling for it. They're like, you know what? Wake us up when you have an answer.
Sudeep, what do you think? Do you buy that?
I think the markets have been trained not to react, and this is the first time after all the fights we had about prior threats of a government shutdown in 2011, the debt ceiling battle, the fiscal cliff. This is the first time we're going to see us going past the deadline with real effects on the government and on the economy beyond just fear, which is what we've had a lot before. And so this is actually going to be a very important test for us to see what does our government do, what's its proper role in our economy, and for us to actually evaluate that in perhaps a more sensible way. So it could be a clarifying moment for all of us.
Let's hope it works. Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Heidi Moore from The Guardian. She's in New York City. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, see you. As I said, Wall Street could not have cared less about this whole thing. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Here's another deadline we're all going to have to deal with sooner rather than later. Taxes. Hours. As in, they're due in like 6 weeks. The good news is that after filing your 1040, there is sometimes a refund. And for a lot of the working poor, that's the most money they'll see in their bank accounts all year. And it can go fast. So fast that sometimes it's spent before the check from Uncle Sam even arrives. WPLN's Blake Farmer reports for the Wealth and Poverty Desk on the refund frenzy in Nashville, Tennessee.
Vernon Sheridan and his wife are finishing up the paperwork to buy an entire new living room set.
We have green chairs to a chocolate table, and she wanted to keep the green tone.
Sheridan draws blood for a living. He's also a part-time divinity student online. Money does get tight, but with his refund on the way, Sheridan is at least feeling a little richer.
What it really feels like is we're getting free money, and you just don't know what to do with it. So you do what comes to mind, and that's buy furniture, vehicles, eat, take vacations. You know, you pretty much spend it the fastest way you can.
In fact, Sheridan is pre-spending. This furniture store attracts hordes of expectant refund recipients, says co-owner Wesley Griggs.
Even if people don't have their tax check, we can still get them their furniture, and they have 3 months to pay it off, same as cash. So they can have it now, and once they get the refund check, they can just pay it off.
So they can spend the refund check before they get the refund check.
That's correct.
Some retailers have come to depend on refund season. At the lowest income levels, families could be getting a third of what they make in an entire year. Griggs says they often come ready to spend.
I would probably say that during the first quarter, 75% of the clientele that walks in the store, they already know that they're spending their tax refund check on furniture.
Many companies run special promotions. A chain of used car lots called AutoMasters advertises a match for refund checks up to $1,500.
How is everyone doing, Mr. Phillips? Congratulations, you're very close to getting your new vehicle, which we're proud of.
Adrian Longoria is a fast-talking salesman, but he brushes off questions about whether he's preying on customers. Longoria sees the tax refund deal as a way to help people find reliable transportation.
Maybe the one time a year when they do have revenue for a down payment, it allows us to hopefully get them in a new car, truck, or van. Pre-owned, of course.
Still, a recent study by Harvard's Kennedy School found a remarkably small amount of tax refunds are spent on splurging. Sociology professor Catherine Eden says if big purchases are made, they're often an investment toward a better life.
They're very aspirational. They have, you know, high hopes, and, you know, they want to buy a washer and dryer so they can save the time they would spend schlepping, you know, the clothes to the laundromat.
According to the Harvard study, only about 10% of refund money goes into what might be considered binge spending. Melissa Cole is buying a stereo for her new car.
It didn't have a radio, so we just bought another one.
Cole purchased the 2004 Chevy Impala with her refund. The mother of two recently quit her job as a gas station clerk.
Yeah, it's hard to save up, especially I have two kids. So it's hard to save up money with bills and kids. So when you get your refund, it's there.
And now that refund is a car, that Cole hopes will get her to her next job. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
One of the reasons House Republicans don't feel much of a sense of urgency about the budget cuts that start today is that they're kind of abstract. No set timeline, no clear definition of who exactly gets hit. So you can kind of understand that. Richard Crow, however, most definitely does not. He's a steelworker, or he was, till he was laid off 9 months ago. He's been collecting unemployment since, which, as it happens, is one of the programs that's being cut because of the budget cuts. Mr. Crow, good to talk to you, sir.
You too.
So tell me, first of all, whether you've been following news of these budget cuts. You've been paying attention?
Oh, yeah.
You said that pretty quickly. I guess you've been paying pretty close attention.
Yeah, I kind of watch everything that happens in Washington, especially when you're laid off and you ain't got a job and you're watching these people not doing their job.
So now that this sequester thing has happened, what happens to you? I mean, part of the cuts here are going to be cuts in unemployment, and it's going to come pretty soon at the end of the month.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing, but, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens. That's what the unemployment told us to do, just file it and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, it's going to be, you're going to be losing 10 or 11%, right?
Yeah.
So what's that going to mean? I mean, how much are you getting now?
I get 764 every 2 weeks.
So you lose $76, takes you down to something like $670. What's that going to mean for you?
It ain't enough to begin with, you know. Then you're losing money on top of it. You know, it ain't good. You know, I struggle to pay bills now.
Is it just you, or you have a wife and kids?
I have a wife and a son. My son's out on his own, and my wife does work, but she don't make a living wage.
So, do you have a backup plan? You got a plan B?
Just looking for a job. I've applied for over 200 jobs, and the ones that answer you back are thank you for your interest.
I wonder, Mr. Crow, whether you think anybody's paying attention to you and all the people out there like you.
I really don't. I really don't think so. And I'm at a point where I feel nobody even cares about us people, you know, that worked all our lives. I come out of high school and went into the steel mill. It's the only job I ever had. And, you know, I don't have no experience doing nothing else. And, you know, the steel industry's not very, you know, it's shrunk in this country. And, you know, I was just hoping to get enough years so I could retire out of there, but I come up short. But I don't think people want to take a chance on you. You know, I've worked my whole life. I don't want to be out here on unemployment, but I don't think the 535 people down here care. Any of them care about you. You know, one side's one way, the other side's another way. You know, and they don't want to get nothing done for the American people.
Richard Crow from the great state of Ohio, waiting on his unemployment checks to get cut as part of that sequester. Mr. Crow, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, something to think about over dinner.
There was a case made in Scientific American in 1875 that if the U.S. started eating horses, that there'd be a really strong economic benefit to that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 35 points today, 0.25%, hit 14,089, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ added 9 points, 0.3%, 3.169%. The S&P 500 rose 3 points, 0.25%, ended things at 1518. Sequester schmequester, I would say. For the week, the Dow gained 0.6%. The NASDAQ earned 0.3%. The S&P 500 rose 0.2%. Shares of Groupon bounced back 12.5% after losing nearly a quarter of its value yesterday. It turns out investors had a pretty good sense of humor about CEO Andrew Mason being fired. You should see his note in which he says why he was fired. U.S. automakers posted decent sales figures for February. Shares of GM drove up 0.2%. Ford was pretty much flat. Investors found shares of retailer Best Buy a good buy after the company reported better than expected profits. Today, the stock price ran up a 3.5% gain. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.85%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In New Orleans, the BP oil spill trial enters its second week. On March 4, 1861, Abraham Lincoln became the 16th president of the U.S. when he was sworn in on the steps of the unfinished Capitol. And in Dallas, the TV Dallas, that is, TNT is promising an end to the infamous scheming J.R. Ewing, long played by the late actor Larry Hagman. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is, of course, a day that was never supposed to happen. Budget cuts so unimaginable as to be inconceivable. And yet here we are. So since this whole thing was supposed to be hypothetical anyway, let's just play along, shall we? What do you suppose would happen if the budget cuts that start by midnight tonight actually stuck? What will the economy look like a year from now if congressional Republicans keep on doing nothing? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark and David Weinberg did a little time travel for us. And it's not pretty.
Hey, David.
Hey, Chrissy, what's up?
Oh, you know, I'm just hanging out in line at LAX right now. Now that there are so many fewer TSA workers, it takes like 4 hours to get through the airport security lines, which sucks because I missed a really important meeting today.
That reminds me of what economist Gus Fauché from PNC Financial told me back in 2013.
Longer lines at the airport, flight delays, those types of things, that makes workers less productive. It makes businesses less willing to have their employees travel, so that could be a drag on growth.
Anyway, I'm just killing time right now, but I also wanted to apologize for the fact that I still haven't gotten a Christmas present for you. I know it's March, but the present I was going to get you is on back order. It just takes so much longer to get things in sequester land. Something about how container ships are being diverted from U.S. ports to Canada because it takes so long for Customs and Border Patrol to inspect the cargo at ports in the U.S. Daniel E., he's a spokesman for the Port of Long Beach, warned me about this.
If the shipping lines start seeing a huge bottleneck here, they're going to start, you know, in over the long run, they're going to start planning around it, and they're going to plan to move more cargo via other ports.
Hey, where are you going anyway?
Actually, I'm headed to a military base to do some interviews for a story I'm working on. I'm going to talk to some folks who've been furloughed. They're only working 4 days a week now. It reminds me of something Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments told me last year.
People will definitely start to see the furloughs for DOD civilian employees. And again, these are not contractors. These are civil servants who work directly for the Department of Defense.
Wait, hang on a sec. The U.S. spends so much on its military. There are plenty of areas where we can make cuts without compromising safety. And the U.S. has started to lower its debt, so more banks are willing to lend. Economist Gus Fauché told me this back in 2013.
Businesses go out and invest in equipment and software and in buildings in order to make their firms more productive and increase profits. So that would be a positive for the economy. And then households would be borrowing. They'd be borrowing to purchase a new home or to, buy things like cars or appliances.
So what are you doing, David?
I'm just running errands, walking down the street. God, it's crazy how many homeless people you see on the street these days. In fact, Nick Retsinas at Harvard Business School, he saw this coming a year ago.
If you were very poor and you were a beneficiary of federal housing programs, you might have lost your subsidy. Your rent, basically your payment for rent, might have grown and expanded very dramatically. If you were in a shelter, you might find that the doors were closed.
Though some people are moving into new homes. I was driving by some open houses last week, and there were lines out the door. And that's exactly what Mark Zandi, economist at Moody's Analytics, predicted.
Housing, which had been ground zero for for our problems is definitively turned, and that's so key to the economy, to the job market, to everyone's wealth and spending. So I think that's going to help provide enough juice to keep us out of recession. Most likely scenario is the economy kind of muddles through for the next 9-12 months. The world looks a year from now much like it looks today.
Of course, it's hard to figure out exactly how the economy is doing now, since with the cuts to the Department of Commerce, they're a lot slower at putting out those reports on GDP.
Oh, the TSA is finally getting me through this line. I gotta go now.
All right, see you later, Chrissy.
Okay, bye, David.
While those at the top of government departments and agencies are trying to figure out how to cut budgets and spread the pain, those down lower on the organizational charts are actually working, trying to connect citizens to their government. The Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, has been pretty good at that lately. Their latest effort is an app, their third app, in fact. This one is called Solve the Outbreak, as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
The new CDC app offers three virus outbreaks to solve. The first, birthday party gone bad.
Five children who attended a birthday party have been admitted to a local hospital with severe diarrhea. CDC's team of Epidemic Intelligence Service officers, known as disease detectives, is called in to help investigate.
The disease detectives are real, and the app's based on real cases they solved. It's a far cry from, say, blockbuster video games or movies about outbreaks.
Your town is being quarantined.
Team dead. You got 100 more infected.
People are still trying to find what that sort of sweet spot is where, you know, you can have those teachable moments without obviously over-dramatizing it.
Dr. Stephen Morse teaches epidemiology at Columbia University. He says some CDC fun projects, like a zombie-themed campaign a while back, went too far afield. But he sees this as a real educational tool. James Gee studies education and games at Arizona State. He says games are great for teaching science.
It is actually instructing. People think, well, there's no teacher when using a game, but there is a teacher, the game designer.
And in this case, the game designer is a group of scientists leading you along the same trail of clues they followed. Was it the ice cream at that fateful birthday party or the swimming pool? Now that's problem solving. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Okay, horse meat. It has now turned up in grocery stores in the UK and in meatballs from IKEA. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is talking about approving a horse slaughterhouse in New Mexico, the first in this country in more than 5 years. The unease that many feel about horses as food is not new, as Colin Schultz wrote recently for Smithsonian Magazine. Colin, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is not the first time you discovered that we've been up in arms about eating horses, is it?
No, it's the debate over whether or not to eat horse meat actually has a really long and, I think, quite fascinating history.
All right, well, give it up. How long and how fascinating?
The debate goes back thousands of years, but the part of the story that I found that was most interesting goes back to the 19th century, to the late 19th century. In 1870, the Prussian army was moving in on Paris, and they surrounded the city, and there was blocks of the supply route, so there's no food really moving in and out. The French started just relying on whatever they had available for food. So they turned to cats and dogs and horses and just any sort of meat or food that they could find. The story that I found about horses, there's a real hesitancy. The people didn't want to start eating horses. But, you know, when you're short on food, you do what you need to do. And then the siege ended. And because people developed a fondness for the taste, eating horse continued. And then there became a little bit of an international debate over whether that practice should spread.
Was the United States involved in that debate? I mean, what's our relationship with that, you know, late 19th century horse-eating phenomenon?
So what I found when I was digging was there was a case made in Scientific American in 1875 that if the U.S. started eating horses, that there'd be a really strong economic benefit to that. So there's already all these horses around, but we could derive extra value from them if we started using them as food in addition to using them as tools or workhorses or whatever the use was at the time.
Like how much value?
So the estimate for the U.S. horses was about $30 million.
And that's in 1870-something dollars, right?
Yeah. So taking inflation, that's a pretty big industry.
That's a boatload full of money. And so the question is, why didn't it ever catch on? I mean, you'd think that somebody would have put dollars ahead of sensibilities at some point.
Yeah, but I think, you know, there's a real strong American ethos against it. You know, you sort of see horses as companions. You see horses as pets. Even at the time, horses as tools, but there was still, you know, sort of that iconic Old West imagery of the horse, right? It's not something, you don't want to then eat that horse. People would have had the same repugnancy to it that they have now.
That they have today, yeah. And by now, that debate's over with, right?
Yeah, and, you know, the economic value argument is also sort of gone because there aren't, like, if we could start eating cars, that would be the same argument, right? We can't. So, you know, the analogy is a little bit lost to time.
Colin Schultz, he writes on the SmithsonianMagazine.com about horses and the history of eating. Colin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which Warren Buffett basically tells corporate America to stop all the whining. Buffett is out with his annual letter to shareholders in his holding company, Berkshire Hathaway. He is, as befits a guy worth many billions of dollars, relentlessly positive about the prospects for the American economy. So positive, in fact, that he has a message for CEOs worried about the uncertainty today's political climate brings. There has always been uncertainty, he said, and to quote, "If you're a CEO who has some large, profitable project you are shelving because of short-term worries, call Berkshire. Let us unburden you," he says. He also, by the way, adds up the total percentage change in the value of Berkshire Hathaway stock since he started running that company in 1964. Hang on to your hats. Ticker symbol BRK, the A shares, up 586,817% in the past 5 decades. All right, we're done on a Friday. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow picked up 35 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ added 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 up 3 points. That's 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up on our personal financial marketplace money this weekend, there is lots of fun stuff to talk about in a relationship. Money, however, is not one of them.
I see couples who are really, really skillful, smart people in every area of their lives seem to malfunction when it comes to money. And money is often the number one issue that they have disharmony and conflict around.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.